Tonight's Enough Rope is rated M for a mature audience. It contains coarse language.
Thank you. Good evening. Welcome to Enough Rope. As the war on terror edges ever closer to home, we're beginning to ask ourselves a hard question. To protect a free society, how many freedoms are we prepared to give up? My first guest has spent most of his life at the pointy end of this question. As a QC, he's campaigned for human rights across the world. He's prosecuted heads of state and defended men on death row. His clients have included IRA bombers, dissidents, Salman Rushdie and Johnny Rotten. One of the world's great legal minds, he's led a life that would have exhausted any three normal men and all without a hair out of place. Please welcome Geoffrey Robertson.
That is a much kinder introduction than I got when I spoke in Glasgow the other night. The chairman, with a very Scots accent, said, "I want you to meet a distinguished liar." That sums up my career perhaps more accurately than you have.
Oh, if only I'd thought of it. Actually, I was disappointed. If you were disappointed in my introduction, I was disappointed in the way you walked out. I expected you to come out like this.
That was the last time we met. You were a guest on my show.
That's right.
And this is revenge?
That was hypotheticals. This is patheticals. Not to be confused. Do you get nervous before doing something like this?
Always. But not as nervous as I get before going into court. It's a terrible thing to have another person's fate in your hands. This is what John Mortimer would teach me. He'd always throw up in the robing room.
Really?
Hmm.
And you? I mean, not suggesting you throw up. What did you do to deal with your nerves?
Well, it's very... court is very slow, very quiet. You can deal with nerves by thinking thoughts about the judge.
What sort of thoughts?
That the judge is doing what every human being has to do, and although terrifying he or now she may be, they are only human.
Do you, when you're getting to know a jury over a case which could last many months, do you start to single out jurors? Do you think I can work on that one?
Yes, you do. You always look at the reading matter that they're carrying under their arm. If they carry Mr. Murdoch's son, you know that they're not going to be in your favour. I would...
I'd always
select jurors who had the Financial Times under their arm, because they would be more likely to find a reasonable doubt. In the old days, in the Oz trial, for example, we used to get the jurors' names the night before. And I remember we had a juror named William Blake. And we thought, we have to select this juror. When William Blake came in, he was he had a badge on that represented a fascist society. He had the sun under his arm. We had to challenge him.
Yes. Not quite the mystic poet and artist you've been expecting.
Not quite the man who would acquit Oz if he was still alive, no.
Let's talk about that. We've got a still here of the slightly pornographic Rupert Bear really had a huge impact on your career. Can you explain how?
Well, it was the end of the swinging 60s, and I think the establishment in Britain wanted scapegoats for those they thought had been responsible for this wave of permissiveness. And they picked on Richard Neville and a couple of other Australians and decided, they charged them with conspiracy to corrupt public morals, which carried life imprisonment.
As you said, this was the end of the permissive 60s in London. What you found in the form of Judge Michael Argyle was a remarkably conservative man. When he thought one of the defendants had talked about having VD, what did he do?
Oh, well, that was John Peel, who died last year, was a great radio announcer.
One of the witnesses, sorry.
He, this BBC disc jockey had admitted having VD in order to encourage people to go and have treatment for sexually transmitted diseases, a very valuable thing to do. But Judge Argyle was so shocked at this admission that the glass of water out of which the witness had sipped during his testimony, after he left the witness box, he ordered the usher to smash the glass of water so that in case anyone else got infected.
He was completely confused by the term cunnilingus?
He was totally confused. He pronounced it cunnilinctus, as though it were an Irish airline. He said to one witness, George Melly, who's a wonderful jazz singer and sociologist, he said, can you help members of the jury with this phrase, cunnilinctus? They may not have done Latin. And George, who had been an able seaman in the war, said, I'm glad you asked me that. Sucking or blowing, my lord, or going down, or in my naval days, gobbling. In my naval days, we had another phrase, yodeling in the canyon. And, of course, the audience burst into laughter. The usher called for silence. The judge said, this is a courtroom, not a theatre. But, of course, it had become a theatre because of the absurdity of this particular judge.
It's remarkable to think that was the early 70s we're talking about. You mentioned John Mortimer, who became the barrister for the defence. He also counselled you the first time you lost a case, didn't he?
Yes, he did say I shouldn't take loss personally, and he took me aside and explained that that we had to be dispassionate and distance ourselves from the client.
That's easily said, but hard to do. After the Oz trial, you went on to Jamaica, and a man called Michael X, an Englishman who was on death row in Jamaica.
Yeah, he was a black radical, and he'd been sentenced to death, and that was the first time I spent a long time on death row with him. Death row is really a terrible place in the Caribbean. It's like these men are in monkey cages. They're screeching. The noise level is tremendous. They're treated like animals. Every Thursday, I think, the warden would come down and read the death warrant, and then the hangman would come and weigh the man, grease the trap, and it was an obscene ritual that they went through. But in that period with Michael X on death row, it did strike me that death row is a form of torture. And later I was able to get scientific evidence of this, and we brought a case in which the Privy Council, which is the highest court for the Caribbean, declared that all those who'd been on death row for more than a couple of years had to have their sentences commuted because death row was torture, and hundreds of people were then taken off death row, and that argument was accepted only last month in Uganda. It's being run in the Supreme Court of the United States.
You grew up in the suburbs of Sydney. Where did this strong sense of injustice come from?
Well, people always ask me who was my inspiration as a kid, and they expect me to say Nelson Mandela or Dr. Evatt or Pastor Niamhola. It was none of those people. It was Lou Hode. He was my idol as a boy growing up in Eastwood. He was he'd beaten Tony Trey, but he'd won the Davis Cup single-handed. And in a strange sort of way, a barrister is not unlike a professional tennis player. You go from court to court, winning some, losing some, complaining about the umpire, making a lot of money. But, of course, to be a professional tennis player, you have to be brilliant. To be a barrister, no brilliance is required in the law, as John Mortimer's father told him, just common sense and relatively clean fingernails.
I still don't see how you jumped from admiring a tennis player, and I know you love tennis, to deciding to spend your entire life...
No, I think there was... Look, I grew up in... in Eastwood. My wife calls me a Westie. And my grandfather came from Dapto. I spent a lot of time in Dapto. And there was a rumour a few years ago in the British press that when Mr Blair got in, that I'd be made a lord, and then I'd be able to attach to my lordship some place where I had hereditary association. So Lord Robertson of Dapto was on the line. But my wife scuppered all that. She explained that my early forebears were Scottish crofters from the Isle of Muck. And so Lord Robertson of Muck would allow Cathy Lett to realise her ambition of becoming Lady Muck.
You would have to be one of the most articulate men in the world, I suspect, and yet you didn't even talk till the age of five, is that right?
No, I didn't. And when I did talk, I talked in this voice that had the tones of the failed BBC announcers that came over to work on the ABC after the war, and so I had this speech impediment. I spoke like a pom.
You've lost that now.
Well, Private Eye calls me an Australian who's had a vowel transplant. But it happened when I first got to England, of course, and first made it to the Old Bailey, my very first case, I still had those irritable Australian vowels that France and branch. And I had to defend an Australian. He'd been convicted. I was doing the appeal. And I said, my lord, this is a case about a T-shirt, whether it's indecent. The logo was fuck art, let's dance. And there was a terrifying silence. And the judge said, fuck art, let's what, Mr. I said, dance. Dance, my lord. There's another silence. He said, oh, you're an Australian. What you have to learn in these courts, Mr. Robertson, is to say, fuck art, let's dance. There was lots of sycophantic laughter, and I think the judge was so pleased at embarrassing a young barrister that he acquitted my client. But I learned very quickly to say dance.
So when you were speaking like an expatriate British radio announcer, do your parents have a very Australian accent?
No, not at all.
I know you're still very close to your parents, aren't you?
I took my father down to Canberra for the Victory in the Pacific celebration. He was a fighter pilot in 75 Squadron, which was Australia's first fighter squadron, formed in those who held Port Moresby in those terrifying 44 days between the fall of Singapore and the Battle of the Coral Sea. I made a film for the ABC about it on the 50th anniversary, called 44 Days. It was a very hard film to make, very hard to do anything for the ABC, as you probably know, but I went in to see David Hill and I told him the story of 44 Days. He said, great story, we'll show the film. You get the money and make it, we'll show the film. So where do you get $200,000 to make a film? I went to Peter Abels, who'd become head of Ansett and ran Hayman Island. And at the time I was defending Salman Rushdie, who had just been hit by the fatwa and had gone into hiding. So I said to Peter Abels, I've got a great deal for you. You need publicity for Hayman Island. I'll arrange for Salman to hide at Hayman Island. And when he comes out of hiding, we'll announce where he was. Hayman Island will get publicity around the world. All you have to do is give me $200,000. And he thought for a moment, and Peter Abels made a decision. He said, Jeffrey, I'm going to give you $200,000 to make your film on one condition, that you guarantee me that Salman Rushdie never sets foot on Hayman Island.
When you took your dad down for the anniversary, was it an emotional reunion for him, or is it that more laconic?
Look, these guys were ordinary men doing extraordinary things at a time when, the only time in Australia's history, where we've been in peril of invasion. And they fought till they were down to three Kitty Hawks. And the Japanese fleet had just been sighted. And they were ordered to run a kamikaze mission. The last three planes would attack this massive Japanese fleet. And the CEO, of course, said, well, I take one plane. And he said to all the pilots, I want two volunteers to take the other two planes. Everyone stepped forward. Mm. That, I think, epitomises Australian mateship under the most severe circumstances. And it's a wonderful story.
If I could leap to the other side of your public life, so many people know you for, which is the hypotheticals. We've got a clip here of you in action with Gough Whitlam.
Oh. Gough Whitlam, you've auditioned for the part of Captain La Perouse. Do you have enough arrogance, do you think, to play a Frenchman? A French aristocrat?
I would have the aristocratic qualities rather than the Gallic.
Two great legal minds in action there. You created delicious scenarios and often put people out of their comfort zone. What are some of your favourite memories of people's reactions?
Yes, I invented a tax scheme once, a tax evasion scheme that I found a couple of years later Jokey Peterson had put into practice.
And people say he was a fool. That very hypothetical that you had one that Joe Bjelke-Petersen was on.
I did.
That's where you also met your future wife, Kathy Lett.
Yeah.
Let's look at this historic moment.
It's 4 o'clock. It's time for your little baby's feed. What do you do?
I would unbutton my blouse, take my breast out and breastfeed the baby.
At a Sunday school picnic?
Of course. Men drink beer at the Sunday school picnic, so why can't I breastfeed?
Oh, they've been drinking 4X. That's mother's milk in Queensland.
That's exactly right.
That was your first meeting, wasn't it?
It was. That was the first moment we met. It was at a Sunday school picnic in Melanoma, a little town in Queensland.
Yes.
Joe Bjelke-Petersen was the local mayor. In fact, it was a strange story because Kathy was a last-minute replacement for Kylie Minogue. Because I'd persuaded Sir Joe to come on the show and I wanted to sit him next to someone completely different, someone young and beautiful and uncorrupt. And Kylie accepted, but she couldn't make it at the last minute. So as I was getting on the plane to Australia, I got a telegram from the ABC saying, Kylie can't make it. You'll have to make do with Kathy Lett. And I've been making do with her ever since.
I just wonder if we can just replay the two raised eyebrow moments there of Kathy, because it seems to me there's some... were there sparks happening then and there?
Not then and there, no. I was thinking of everyone else as well as Kathy and doing the show. But no, later we got together and... the rest is history.
Well, you did get together.
And two children, yes.
Because I read you said, I think I slept with Kathy before I ate with her.
It was obviously... I didn't eat much in those days.
Mr. Robertson, I would ask you please to answer the question. You had described yourself at university as you had the sense of yourself as the last person ever to join an orgy. Were you surprised with the passion that you discovered? So, apparently instantly with Kathy?
Well, soon after, yes. No, it was one falls in love, and it's a wonderful feeling, and it's you go with it.
You and Kathy play strip croquet, is that right?
Oh, dear. That was up at Billy Connolly's castle, where we invented this game of strip croquet because we had a lot of American guests who were very straight and very naive, and we... pretended that this was a grand old Scottish game in which when you missed the shot you had to take an item of clothing off, and so we did get them naked and exit pursued by midges, which are a problem in Scotland. But when we joked about it afterwards, they said, well, you know, we've just been to watch these men wearing dresses, throwing telegraph poles. We didn't think strip croquet was very much of a leap.
You're not telling the whole story. You cheated, didn't you?
Did I?
Yes, you did. Didn't you wear a great deal of clothing, all of you?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
That's right. We came dressed in
No
many,
further questions, Mr. Many, Robertson.
Many layers of clothes.
Yes, that's right. You said that Kathy and your kids always never fail to remind you of your fallibilities. What are they?
Oh, well, my children. I mean, we've got children the same age, and they think I'm a terrible geek. Geek, it seems to be the word. You know, I wrote a beautiful Saturday morning. I say, come on, kids, we'll go to the British Museum. Oh, Dad, you're such a geek. Dad, you're prehistoric. You belong in a museum. We're going shopping.
As you said, John Mortimer, and you spoke about it, is a fearful thing to have another person's responsibility for another person's life in your hands. Never more so, in some ways, than with your own children. Mm. What do you find most challenging about raising children in this age?
The most difficult thing about raising them in London, of course, recently, has become terrorism and how to explain it to them. They're very bright. On the day the London bombs went off, my daughter was to make a presentation to the Bishop of London. Well, of course, the Bishop of London was tending the dead and dying and couldn't come, but the speech day went ahead, and as it should have done. And I think it's very important to be able to talk, to watch the news with them and talk through with them the world in which they've got to live.
Which brings us to the question of terror and what it's doing to society. Mm. Your book, The Tyrannicide Brief, is about John Cook, a barrister who took on the case no one wanted to take on, to prosecute King Charles I. Mm. A king above the law, appointed by God. And within this book, you discuss what you believe is the bedrock principle of law, which is that every accused should have the right to a proper defence. Assuming he were to be caught, does that apply to Osama bin Laden?
Absolutely. If by some strange twist of fate, Osama bin Laden came out of a cave in Pakistan tomorrow with his hands up, yes, we have to resist the temptation to shoot a man we believe to be guilty in cold blood. We have to resist the temptation to throw him before a non-judicial tribunal in Guantanamo Bay. We have to give him a fair trial, a trial as fair as the horrors of the times permit.
Pre-September 11th, you actually said you felt the world was on the dawn of an era of universal human rights. Since then, of course, we've seen a litany of things. Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, beheadings of people on video. We've seen the shooting of an innocent man in London. Now we're seeing laws against hate speech. We're seeing secret terror courts being proposed. How do we tread that line between protection of an open society and an open society?
Look, we've had 400 years of dealing with terrorists, beginning with Guy Fawkes, who wanted to blow himself up and the Houses of Parliament. I think if there's one lesson that we've learnt, and I've prosecuted terrorists, I've defended them, I've judged them, it is that in the fight against terror, you do not weaken or abolish fundamental liberties, because when you do so, that gives the terrorist the support and the sympathy that they need in which to breed. I mean, what is the greatest recruiting poster for Al-Qaeda today throughout the Middle East? It's the pictures from Abu Ghraib. Why did Abu Ghraib happen? Sadists on the night shift, says the report. The sadists on the night shift, Lindy English and the Alsatians, got the cue from those men in the White House who said, the Geneva Conventions are quaint, are obsolete. That sent the message. So I think the first lesson is that we must cling to fundamental civil liberties at a time of terror in order to defeat the terrorists by preventing them getting that pool of support.
You've seen every possible form of human behaviour. What makes the world a beautiful place for you?
Oh, my family, my children, and my father taking him to the reunion of 75 Squadron, staying with my mother, who cooks me the best breakfast in the world, oysters on toast. Sydney Rock oysters on toast. Being with my kids, even being called a geek. Teaching my son to practice his Lou Hode forehands. That's really what makes me happy. Mm. And it's a desire that I'm sure it's what makes us all happy.
Geoffrey, you may be a geek, but you're one of the most awesome geeks I've ever met in my life. Thank you very much.
Thank you.